So as I texted out earlier this week, we are going to be looking at Exodus 7 through 11. That is obviously a lot, so I will not be reading all of it as we go, but please feel free to follow along as we go through this account. I am also aware it is a fairly familiar account. It is the plagues. It is what most people think of when they think of the book of Exodus. So we've probably seen movies or depictions. We've probably heard about this, many of us, from the time we were children. So I'm aware that this is familiar territory. And that's one of the reasons that I do want to address it as a whole. And because also the themes and the main point of this whole section is best seen when addressed all at once. So I know it is a huge chunk to bite off, but I did want to address it all at once. I am also aware that there is a ton of really cool stuff in this whole section, and there are a lot of details and questions that I will not have time for, and I apologize in advance for that. I wish I could talk about everything and all of the cool connections that are made. I literally had to slim down my brainstorming material in half to make it a normal and acceptable size sermon. So I really enjoyed researching this, and I would not mind at all if you have questions that you want me to address later in the Q&A at the end of the sermon, or even just offline, one-on-one. And this section, again, like I said, is best addressed as a whole. There are a couple reasons for this. The first is that, literarily speaking, it is actually just one section, and that is seen through the fact that it opens and closes with a summary statement. Bruce read 7:1 through 11. If you look at, not all translations will do this, like the ESV actually doesn't, but if you look at 7:1 through 7, that is actually the introduction pretty much of the plagues themselves. And then the section closes in 11:10 with a very brief closing statement before we transition into some things to do with the Passover and the 10th plague. In these summaries and summaries and statements, honestly, all throughout the book of Exodus, before and after and during this section, we will also see that the purpose of the plagues is one purpose. Again, part of the reason that I just want to address this all together. There's one purpose for the plagues, and that is to demonstrate that Yahweh is Lord. So, like, honestly, that's the sermon right there. The rest is just details. But the whole point of the plagues is that Yahweh is Lord. The main point of these chapters and everything that God does in Egypt is to demonstrate that he is Lord. He will conquer Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt. He will deliver his covenant people. It is going to happen, and how we get there is the story that we're going to be looking at most of, and there's still some left afterwards, so we're only doing the first 9 plagues today. The plague's primary purpose was to show Moses and the Israelites, Pharaoh and the Egyptians, and the world at large, as we'll see throughout the rest of the Old Testament as they move on from Egypt and go to the nations and to Canaan, we will see that the purpose of the plagues was to show Moses and the Israelites, Pharaoh, the Egyptians, and the whole world that the Lord is Lord of all. It is a visible Bible for God's people and the whole world in a time when there was not yet a written scripture. This is scripture. What is happening in Egypt is a Bible. And it is a clear message. Every single part of it has theological messaging. It is meant to teach. And I'm going to walk us through that as we walk through these first 9 plagues. And this purpose, this unified purpose, is repeated again and again. I had a list of like 14 purpose statements that we see throughout the book of Exodus. I'm only going to read 2. The first one actually comes just before what was read. It's from a section that we looked at 2 weeks ago, because last week was Christmas. But 6 through 8 read, "Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people. I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord." This is from chapter 6. This is right after Moses was discouraged because he had gone to Pharaoh. Pharaoh had said no. Pharaoh had made their burdens worse. He had beaten the taskmasters and given them impossible demands on their daily tasks. And Moses and the Israelites are discouraged. This is the answer that God gave to Moses to give to the people at that time. And then in 7, 4 through 5, part of what was just read, we read, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring my hosts, my people, and the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the people of Israel from among them. Again, these are just two of the many, many repetitions of this purpose. By the time the plagues are done, not only are God's people delivered from Egypt, but the Israelites, the Egyptians, and the whole world will see that Yahweh is Lord in a way that they will never forget, that we still teach about today. This purpose is not only seen in the summary and purpose statements throughout the narrative, but also in the events themselves and the meaning behind them. To show this, I want to walk through the nine plagues, tracing two different themes as we go. The first theme we will be tracing is the plagues as a polemic or an attack on the deities and religious system itself of Egypt. The second theme that we will be tracing at the same time is the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. In both of these, we will see that God is working to show that he is Lord. The first theme, the plagues as a polemic against the gods of Egypt, is made explicit in 12:12, which I know is just beyond what we're reading. But in this verse, in the instructions for the Passover, we read, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord." That statement is why I'm going to be walking through the plagues in the way that I am, to help us understand what that means. Because without understanding the gods of Egypt, without understanding the religious system, that statement really for us has no impact. So I'm going to unpack that as we go through these nine plagues. Through all the plagues, the Egyptians would have been waiting for their gods to step in and bring order. We think about the plagues, and we think we would be sitting there like, okay, what is the natural explanation? That's not how the ancient world worked. Gods were geographic gods. There were many gods of Egypt. We'll get there. And the gods were in charge of certain things. The Egyptians would have been sitting there waiting, plague after plague, for their gods to step in and fix it. That's the explanation. That's the solution that they were waiting for. And we see in the plagues that God is going to bring chaos and disorder and destruction to the very things that their gods were supposed to rule, the very things their gods were supposed to keep in order. God is going to take down god after god on their home turf, over things that they are supposed to be in charge of. And he is going to show that he, not they, he is in control. As we work through the plagues, I want to admit up front, though, that some of this is an educated guess or has to be applied more broadly than you might think. This is honestly because there were so many ancient Egyptian deities and their roles often overlapped and changed over time that Egyptologists, which, by the way, I'm definitely not, but I read their work, Egyptologists literally aren't sure if they have identified every god of ancient Egypt, and they also are not sure if they are precisely exactly accurate on the roles at any given year. Like, they have a very good general idea of most of the ancient gods and their roles over centuries, but there is a little bit of ambiguity there. Most of it, though, we can be fairly certain of, or at least broadly speaking. And part of that is honestly because there are clues in the text itself that kind of tips the hand of what god is being attacked. And I will point those out as we go. The second theme that we will be tracing as we go is the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. The motif of stiffening or hardening of Pharaoh's heart runs through the entire Exodus story. It appears directly in the text 19 times and indirectly 4 times. Roughly half of these references are to a choice by Pharaoh himself or to an essential attribute of Pharaoh. And then the other half are attributed directly to God. I am aware that this is part of a larger, very complicated, controversial topic that has been debated for centuries. I do not intend to use this morning to address the topic at large, but rather I'm going to address the topic as we see it unfold here in the book of Exodus. If you have further questions or would like to discuss it more, please just let me know. Since Pharaoh, though, was considered the incarnation of Horus in Egyptian religion and helped to maintain something called Ma'at, which was basically order in the world and in people, that was one of his main tasks. When a pharaoh passed the job on to the next pharaoh, part of the ceremony was that he was called to maintain Ma'at as part of his rule. This theme is therefore, in a way, because of this incarnation of the God status of Pharaoh and because of his call to work with the gods to maintain Ma'at, this theme is actually a subset of the first theme, or the polemic against the gods, because Pharaoh is part of that polemic. This first theme, and honestly both themes as we walk through, are going to be seen before the plagues. They start before. The first mention of Pharaoh's hard-heartedness is an indirect statement in 3:19, where God says, "But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand." This is a statement that Pharaoh is a hard-hearted person. This is very important because I think it answers a fundamental question that must be asked of this whole scenario. What was the condition of Pharaoh's heart prior to Moses even going down to Egypt? I would argue that Pharaoh's heart was hard long before Moses arrived. This also explains Pharaoh's response in chapter 5 that we discussed a couple weeks ago, when he spurns God and essentially says, "Who are you, Yahweh, to make requests or demands in my land?" God had asked Moses to ask a reasonable response, request of Pharaoh, but Pharaoh refuses and instead makes their bondage even worse, spurning both the people and, more importantly, their God. This is the first time that the hardness of Pharaoh's heart is exposed. God knew that Pharaoh would continue to harden his heart. God knew that Pharaoh was a self-exalting person that would not heed even this reasonable request. God knew that as the stakes escalated, Pharaoh would not be the kind of person to back down. And God is okay with taking the responsibility with how far the hardening goes as the process continues. The theme of the attack on the gods also starts before the plagues, as we see in 7:8-13. In this section, we see that Moses and Aaron go before Pharaoh, and to prove themselves, Moses' staff, now being wielded by Aaron because he's the spokesperson, turns to a serpent. The magicians are able to do this as well, but Aaron's staff, or Moses' staff, eats the other serpents. Which to us is like, cool, but it's also kind of weird. There's also a lot of stuff, honestly, about the plagues that, I mean, really, until honestly I did a ton of research into it, I'm just like, that's random. Because it's just like we don't think or have exposure to the normal things that are normal in Egypt. But the serpent, or more specifically the cobra, was one of the two guardian goddesses of Egypt, especially of Pharaoh. A cobra was worn on the headdress of the pharaohs to represent this divine protector of their sovereignty and the death to be dealt to their enemies. It was a symbol of protection and also of power. It is then most ironic that the staff of Moses becomes a serpent, most likely this cobra, and eats the serpents that the magicians conjure. That God's staff-turned serpent kills the magician's serpents would have symbolically said that Pharaoh's throne guardians cannot protect him. They cannot protect him from God's kingship, God's sovereignty. God is Lord of all, stronger than the gods and the goddesses of Egypt, stronger than the protectors of the throne. It is also even symbolic, ironically, about how the staff turns into a serpent and how it turns back into a staff. We don't read it here in chapter 7, but back in chapter 4, we read that God has Moses grab the snake by the tail to pick it up. If you know anything about snakes, that's not the place you pick up a snake. The Egyptian magicians knew of a nerve that they could press on a cobra just behind the head that would stiffen it like a rod. From a distance, it would look like they're holding a rod. When they threw it on the ground, the impact would jolt the snake awake. And then they would pick it up by that same nerve, and it would become a rod. This is likely how the magicians did this and copied it. The thing, though, is that God has Moses pick up the snake by the tail. This is a real rod that becomes a real snake. This isn't a trick. After this, though, we read that Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen. The first plague is then seen in 7:14-25, and this is the Nile turned to blood. As we go into the plagues, it all starts with the Nile. This is significant because this is the center of Egypt. This is home turf. God is starting as central home turf as he can. It was both symbolically and literally the lifeblood of Egypt and prominent in much of their religion. He turns this source of life into a source of death, making it undrinkable. This is the start of God hijacking natural things and processes that the Egyptian gods were supposed to keep in order and dangers that they were supposed to keep at bay. The yearly high and low points of the Nile can become dangerous and filled with sediments and bacteria that can give the water a blood-like hue and cause the death of many fish, producing a foul stench, just as we read in the Exodus account. Egyptian literature throughout history refers to the Nile as blood at these times. What we see in the Bible may be actual blood or may be an intensification of this natural process. This would explain why the magicians knew what to do and why also we do not read Pharaoh asking this to go away. It was a natural process that they understood. The magicians here, as elsewhere, though, cannot reverse what God is doing. When the magicians are able to do something, all they do is make it worse. They add to the problem. They're never actually able to reverse the problem. This explanation would fit the rest of the plagues, besides the last one that we're not addressing this week, in that God takes a possible natural disaster or natural force that the gods of Egypt were supposed to be in control of and shows that he is in control of it, not them. The Nile was deified as the god Hapi, and the regular flooding of the Nile was a manifestation of the god Osiris. Pharaoh himself was also seen as responsible to maintain the proper function of the Nile. Therefore, for this plague to strike the Nile while Pharaoh was standing by the Nile was significant. It was a direct attack against Pharaoh and these gods. We read in the text that as Pharaoh was standing by the Nile, this is when this happened. But we read that Pharaoh's heart remained hardened. He would not listen to them. As the Lord had said, Pharaoh turned and went into his house and did not take this to heart. The second plague is in 8:1-15. It is the frogs. The next plague has always struck me as random. Frogs. Just doesn't seem like that big of a plague, but I don't know. But each year, the flooding of the Nile begins to recede. The frogs mass on the land as part of the reproductive cycle. This divinely worsened and dead fish-ridden Nile would have pushed these frogs further into the land than normal. The Egyptian goddess Heket was a frog-headed goddess who was associated with the multiplication and control of frogs, human fertility, and who helped women in childbirth. That the frogs are said to go even to the bed of Pharaoh, we're not given that detail on accident. That would have symbolically been a threat to the fertility of the royal line itself, because these frogs are not currently under Heket's control. So there is chaos being represented through these frogs all the way to Pharaoh's room, which would mean that chaos, a threat to fertility, has come to Pharaoh himself. The magicians, yet again, are only able to duplicate this. They are not able to make the problem any better. Pharaoh has to ask Moses to have God get rid of the frogs. And when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened his heart, and he would not listen, as the Lord had said. The third and the fourth plagues can be grouped together in a way as flying insects. We see these in 8:16-19 and then 20-32, and these are gnats and flies. The magicians are not only not able to help, but they aren't even able to produce gnats or flies. Due to this failure, they tell Pharaoh that this is the finger of God. Even after this warning, though, we read that Pharaoh's heart was hardened. This fourth plague, flies, is the first time we also read of a separation that occurs between the Egyptians and the Israelites. The first three plagues were likely centered more around the Nile and may not honestly have affected Goshen as much, with the Nile being affected with the first, and then the change in the Nile causing the frogs to go further inland from the Nile than normal, and then probably all the dead frogs were a place of concentration for the gnats. The flies likely, though, would have ventured further, and this would have likely been a stable fly, a vicious, blood-sucking fly. No fun to be around. The Israelites, though, are spared from this plague and the rest of the plagues going forward. In verse 24, we read that the land was ruined by the swarms of flies. There's likely a double meaning here, not just the physical destruction, but also the ceremonial and religious destruction. The priests every day shaved their entire body to avoid presence of bugs in the priestly duties. God has made it very hard to avoid the presence of bugs. The land has been ruined. This is, in a way, an attack against the religious system itself. But after this, we read, Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also and did not let the people go. That the text reads, this time also, and that in 9:34-35, we read that the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, with no direct reference to who did it, but it immediately follows a verse that says, he sinned yet again and hardened his heart, I think helps us to show that verses that say his heart was hardened without directly mentioning God are likely his own doing. In 8:29-32, Moses even directly calls out Pharaoh and says, let not Pharaoh cheat again by not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. But we read a couple verses later that Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also and did not let the people go. He's been warned by his magicians. He's been warned by God. He's been warned by Moses. He's been called out, and he is still hardening his heart. The fifth plague, pestilence on the livestock of Egypt, actually has a great amount of irony in its timing, for it is a direct attack against Egyptian religion. In the discussion in the previous plague between Pharaoh and Moses, Moses said that the Israelites cannot make sacrifices within the land because their sacrifices would be considered an abomination to the Egyptians. Pharaoh had said that you may go make a sacrifice in the land. So he's basically trying to change Moses' request and say, well, yeah, you can go offer sacrifice to your God, but stay here. It might have been his way of saying, hey, if you make this plague go away, we can all do ceremonies now. But Pharaoh says, no, if we make Moses says, no, if we make sacrifices here, the sacrifices we have to make might be an abomination to you because you and your people consider certain animals that we would have to sacrifice to be sacred. So they would stone us. But Pharaoh refuses to let them go. The Egyptians had many deities that were represented with animal form, often many of them livestock. Pharaoh would not let the people go worship God, so God attacks the gods of Pharaoh that his people worship. During this plague, Pharaoh sends people to verify that what God had said, that the Israelites would not suffer from the plague on the livestock, actually happened. And when he received word that this was so, he still refused to listen to God, even after God had warned him the result of his choices. God had said that your refusal will result in the death of livestock, and he still refused. God said that this plague, I will also show separation between my livestock and your livestock. You deify your livestock, and I'm going to show you that your gods are impotent. The next plague we read is boils, and this is in 9:8-12. Boils caused the priests to be so unclean that they could no longer stand before Pharaoh and Moses. They also then would not have been able to perform their priestly duties in general. This is again an attack on the religious system itself, rendering the priests themselves unclean. Effectively, the whole religious Egyptian system has been shut down. Besides Israel, ancient cultures had a symbiotic relationship with their religious practices, which means that the gods, in a very real way, relied on the sacrifices and ceremonies of the people for their sustenance. The gods needed the people, and the people needed God. We don't see that in Israelite religion. We don't see God needing the sustenance from people. But in Egyptian religions and other cultures' religions, you did. So for God to shut down this religion and say that the priests can no longer do these ceremonies and sacrifices was very significant. And effectively what has happened by God shutting down the priests and shutting down the religious systems is that Pharaoh is on his own now. It has always been a God battle, and now it's a one-on-one God battle between God and Pharaoh. This was also likely an attack on multiple gods and goddesses responsible for pestilence and healing. Especially during this God battle, these deities would have been expected to help purify the priests to continue to help Pharaoh in his battle against Moses and God. But they cannot. They cannot heal themselves. Their gods do not step in and heal themselves. They are unclean and cannot help Pharaoh. This is the first mention that the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart that isn't in a summary statement about the events of Egypt as a whole. After five plagues, after being given the opportunity to let the people go in a way that was not an attack on his power, for in the request that God had Moses frame to Pharaoh to let the people go for 3 days to make a sacrifice, culturally speaking, that was a fairly normal request. But God knew Pharaoh would say no to that. He had given him this opportunity. His own magicians had told him that this was the work of God. Pharaoh had been called out for lying. He had been told that his choice to refuse had a direct impact on the severity of the plagues. After all of this, we read for the first time that God hardens Pharaoh's heart. And yet in the next plague, the seventh plague, we see that God gives Pharaoh, in a sense, another chance. As we look at the seventh plague, 9:13-25, we read of heavy hail and flashing fire that comes down to the ground, probably lightning, based on the description. We read in verse 14 that this is a direct attack against Pharaoh and his people. This plague is also an attack on the Egyptian gods and goddesses of the skies, who are shown to be unable to prevent God from throwing down this hail and lightning. We also read in 19 that even after God has hardened his heart, Pharaoh and the people are given a warning and time to get their livestock and workers out of the field to save their lives and avoid needless loss of human and animal life. Even after God has continued this process, he still does not want to see the needless loss of life. God has shut down the Egyptian religious system and is basically saying, don't look to your gods, priests, or Pharaoh for help. Look to me. I am telling you what you need to know. But even after this warning, we read in verses 34 to 35 that Pharaoh sinned yet again and hardened his own heart. His course is now set. Through the rest of the narrative, we read that God confirms and extends this choice by hardening Pharaoh's heart even more. At the beginning and the end of the next plague, and at the end of the ninth plague, we read that God hardens Pharaoh's heart to extend the plagues. The eighth plague, locust. This plague is an attack on the gods responsible to help with vegetation and keeping invasions of locusts at bay. But more importantly, it's an attack on Ra, or Amun-Ra, the sun god, the chief Egyptian deity, believed to be all-powerful, self-created creator of the universe, who brought sun, light, life, and recreation each day. That this is an attack on Ra or Amun-Ra is obscured a little bit in the English. If you look at 10 verse 15, we read that the locust covered the face of the whole land. The word translated face, though, is actually not the word for face. It's the face for eye. There is a different standard word for face that is not used here. It just reads a little awkward, which is why most translations smooth it out. Because to say that the eye of the land was covered sounds kind of weird to us. The eye of the land, though, in Egyptian thought, is the sun. And the eye of the sun was a metaphor for Amun-Ra. So I think there is a allusion here to Ra, Amun-Ra, that the locusts are so thick that they hide Ra, or Amun-Ra. I'm not actually sure which one he's referred to at the time. But the ninth plague, then, this darkness for 3 days, would have been seen as an even more direct and extended assault on Amun-Ra. It was believed that the sun was Amun-Ra aboard his divine vessel, and that every day he shone in the skies, bringing light, life, and new creation, and then at night he went below the earth and fought a demon of chaos called Apophis, and kept him from devouring the earth with darkness and chaos. The rise of the sun each morning represented the victory of Amun-Ra. So for darkness to cover the land 3 days was a dark omen. That it was referred to as a darkness to be felt in verse 21, and that we are told that no one rose from his place for 3 days. They couldn't even walk around with torches. This likely means that it was a divine intensifying of the yearly winds that come in from the desert in the spring, enveloping the land in thick dust and sand. It was so bad through God's intensification that people were unable to leave their houses and walk around. Torches would not work. God had brought a blackout to the land. Ra is gone. He had lost. All along the plagues, God is saying that I am doing this. So the people would have known that this isn't just Ra is taking a while. This is this Israelite God who keeps saying this is going to happen and this is going to happen. This Israelite God has defeated Amun-Ra. That is why this plague is the ninth plague. This is a very significant attack on the Egyptian deities. This is also why it is very significant that Goshen is not in darkness for these 3 days. This defeat of Amun-Ra this bringing and allowing of Apophis to rise in chaos and disorder is against the Egyptians, not the Israelites. After this direct attack on the highest Egyptian deity, Pharaoh calls Moses and says that all the people can go, but they must leave their livestock. Moses points out that they need their livestock for the sacrifices that they must make. And Pharaoh may have let him go. We're not sure. He usually changes his mind anyway, so it probably doesn't matter. But in the midst of the conversation, we read that the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. God's not done yet. As we read in Exodus 11, God has one more plague that he will bring to convince Pharaoh to not just let them leave on a short journey to make sacrifices to God, but to be driven away completely out of their bondage and even be given parting gifts by the Egyptians to encourage them to leave. Pharaoh and the Egyptian deities are thought to be in control of life and death, but God is about to show that he is in control of everything, even life and death itself. God is about to slay the firstborn of humans and of cattle, which to us may sound random, but remember, many Egyptian deities were portrayed through cattle or livestock. So for God to kill the firstborn of people and cattle is basically his way of saying, this thing that's happening, this isn't from your gods. This is from me. In 11:9, we read that God tells Moses, after Moses warns Pharaoh about the final plague, that Pharaoh will not listen to you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. God had given Pharaoh an opportunity to save face in the initial request. He'd given him an opportunity to limit the loss of life in the fifth and the seventh plagues. He'd given warnings and called him out for lying and stubbornness multiple times, but Pharaoh refused all of this and hardened his heart. Besides summary statements, we don't read that God hardened Pharaoh's heart until he had hardened his own many times. It is also instructive to us that in Exodus 13, in the instructions for the consecration and redemption of every firstborn, was an instruction to teach generation after generation that what happened was because Pharaoh suddenly stubbornly refused to let the people go. Even after God hardened his heart for the first time, he gave him another chance, but he refused and sinned yet again and hardened his heart. Through this order, we see that the narrative is constructed in such a way that Pharaoh's personal culpability or responsibility and God's direct involvement are both beyond question. We see that once his own hardness had become habitual and irreversible, which God knew would happen long before he sent Moses, Pharaoh's character becomes his destiny. He was then deprived of the possibility of relenting and was divinely driven on to his self-wrought doom by God continuing to harden his heart so that the full glory and might of the Lord would be demonstrated in a way that the world would not soon forget. The final plague would happen. Another act of judgment would come as the people leave. God, not Amun-Ra, not any other god, not Pharaoh, God is supreme, self-created, creator, God of life and death. It will be shown that he is Lord. Yahweh, the covenant God, who as we have seen throughout the text so far, Yahweh, the covenant God who is faithful, who sees, hears, knows, cares, and acts, and cannot be stopped. He is Lord of all. There is no God greater than him. There is no God, no force on earth that can stop him from accomplishing his plans in his way, in his time. And there is no power on heaven or earth that can separate his people from his love. Through the first nine plagues, God is conquering Pharaoh and the gods and goddesses of Egypt and delivering his people. He is Yahweh, the all-powerful covenant God who will cause his promises to be fulfilled. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this text. I know it contains some hard and some complicated things, but I thank you that throughout all of history, and in this count included, you show us that you are God, that you are covenant God, that there is no force on heaven or earth that can stop your plans, and that we can trust you to fulfill your promises. And I pray that as we continue to work through Exodus and see how these plans continue to unfold, and as we go into this new year, that we will live knowing that you are God, and that we will put our faith in you, that we will not stubbornly refuse you. I pray that we will trust in you and see that you are God through how you work in our lives. I pray all this in your name. Amen.